Hope lunch was enjoyable for you and that you're not going to fall asleep on me. We got topics that are intended to keep people awake this afternoon. There are two specifically we're going to be talking about, and the very nature of these, I'm going to be using some words that you may never have heard in the pulpit before, but the very nature of these, I have to speak in such a way that I'll be understood, but yet not in such a way that I'm offensive. So I walk a little bit of a line on this one. I want to start out this afternoon basically by saying something, finishing up a piece from this morning. I brought with me two sets of charts that if you'll see one of the elders or one of the ministers here, they can make these accessible to you. The first one is on the, it's a chart of addiction and recovery, and you can't see that from where you are, but basically it's in, both of these are inverted bell curves. And on this side, these are the signs and symptoms of people that are going into addiction. And then these are the signs and symptoms of people who are recovering from addiction, what they need to do to recover. This is what's commonly called the Jelinek chart, put together by Dr. Jelinek. What he did is he noticed that the stories that addicts were telling him were the same stories, that the details varied. So he did a chart on that. One that is very similar to it is the impact on the family. And what this does is shows the progression, how the family gets altered or changed as one gets into their addiction. And then in healthy recovery, what families do in order to recover. And so this gives you both the issues of how you get there and how you get back. And these charts, I think, are pretty meaningful. I use these a lot in my family groups. And what I'm usually told by the addict and the family is that on this inverted bell curve, that the bottom is not like you go down and then you go back up, or this way, I guess, but it is more like the pendulum of a clock, that it gets really bad, and then you go back up a little bit, and then you swing forward and start recovery, but it's almost like that magnet at the bottom that holds you there. The very bottom of that chart is called death or insanity, and that's where that'll take families. It'll destroy families, or it will destroy individuals. So if you're interested in those charts, those are available to you in the back. Those are not copyrighted, so you can use them however you want to. But I use those a lot when someone comes and says, I have an alcohol problem or our family has a problem. I say, well, how about just take a look at this chart and put a check mark by the things that look familiar to you. And what that will tell me is kind of where they are. You can use that when you're talking to people as well in that way. Okay, we have a full agenda this afternoon, and I'm going to try to move through this. I want to ask you the question, where did you learn about sexuality? Where did you learn about the facts of life? And when I ask that question, a lot of times what I get is, well, I found some magazine somewhere, or somebody showed me a magazine in the shower room at school, or I was playing out on the internet and stumbled across this. I was doing a homework assignment and hit whitehouse.com instead of whitehouse.gov, and that's how I learned about it. Others will tell you different ways they learned about the facts of life. I'm asking you, where did you learn about the facts of life? Now, if you're like most of our brethren, we have shied away from this issue. And unfortunately, we've let Satan teach us about sexuality. And the information we have has largely, when we talk with brethren, there largely is not a lot of information they have gleaned from the Scriptures, just a place here or there. I want to suggest to you that since God gives us all things that pertains to life, that the Bible, while it is not primarily a sexual manual, is full of sexual instruction. And my task in this next period of time is to go through the Bible with you and show you that God has addressed this subject and that it is not one to be particularly embarrassed about, but it is one where God has clearly spoken on the subject of sexuality. And so my task today is to do something like the Hebrew writer did in Hebrews 11, where he just went through and just cited a whole bunch of things and then summarized it. So I want to do that in this particular lesson and start with that premise that God has granted us all things that pertain to life and godliness. And so we must speak plainly in this lesson, and even more so in the next lesson, that we would be understood. In the very beginning of time, God said, "Let us make man in our own image after our own likeness, And then it tells us in Genesis 1, 26 and 27 that God made all things, and it says, male and female made he them. Gender is ordained of God. Male and female is part of God's plan. The procreation of males and females is part of God's plan, as he commanded them to multiply and replenish the earth. The simple fact there was that Adam and Eve were sexually active prior to the first sin, and then after the first sin, woman's pain was increased in childbearing, was multiplied in childbearing. And so as you look at those scriptures, you'll find some interesting things there. What I want to show is that God has clearly spoken on the subject of sexuality. God said it is not good for man to be alone in Genesis 2 and verse 18. And so he created man. And the text tells us that God performed the first marriage ceremony. And in that, in Genesis 2, verse 23 through 25, he said, the two shall be one flesh, describing the sexual act. And so God ordained that sexual activity is in marriage. Until then, folks, the shop is closed. It's not open for business. The shop's closed. And marriage or sexual expression is intended for the marriage relationship and the marriage relationship only. The very first sins involved sexual things, because in that first sin, what we see is that they were aware of their nakedness. And so they hid themselves. And God asked the question, who told you you were naked? That has to do with their sexuality and their bodies. The implication was that with nakedness would come a sense of shame. And Adam says there in Genesis 2:25 that we were ashamed and we hid ourselves. And God said, well, who told you that you were naked? And then in Genesis 3:7 through 10, we find that they were aware of their nakedness, and that evidently brought some embarrassment, and that they attempted to make some clothing from some leaves, and that wasn't enough to cover them or to take care of the situation. So God made the first set of clothes out of animal skins and brought those to man and woman, Genesis 3, verse 7, and also verse 21. The book of Genesis is the book of beginnings, and in that we find the beginnings of a number of things. We find the beginning of creation. We find the beginning of clothing. We find the issues with nakedness in the very first part there. And then we find the case where there was the first man with two wives in Genesis 4 and verse 19. Then with the flood also came the pairing of males and females, and the two pair of the unclean and the seven pair of the clean. And they were preserved so that there could be procreation when the flood waters receded. So there was a preservation of males and females there in Genesis 7, verse 2 and 3. Noah, after the flood, there was a situation that is a little difficult to decipher from the information we have, but there was something about Noah after the flood. He got drunk and he was naked. And his son Ham came in, and because of the Ham looked on his father's nakedness, then there was a curse that the father placed upon Ham. The other two sons, Shem and Japheth, backed into the place where Noah was laying naked and covered him up. And what that may suggest several things, and there's been several speculations on that, but what I want to suggest to you is that you study that, because that's a part of the sexuality expressed in the Bible. Some have suggested that there was something went on between Noah and his son Ham, and others have suggested such things as that we don't look on the nakedness of our parents, and that is a taboo. You decide what you study that and decide that for yourself. But the Bible does address that, and that's spelled in pretty clear terms. There was the first case of homosexuality is with the city of Sodom and Gomorrah, and the other five cities of the plain. Did you know that there were seven cities targeted to be destroyed? There were seven. And one of those was Zoar, where Lot and his daughters went. And my guess is that's the reason it was spared, because they made up the 10th people that were there, and it was preserved. But whatever, you want to look at that. There were seven cities in the plains. But Sodom and Gomorrah, we study about the city of, we study about homosexuality and how that these men were so perverted in that city that they tried to beat in the door to Lot's house to have a homosexual relationship with these angels that they thought were humans. And then what we find is that they were struck blind and they were so intent in their lust for these males, or what they presumed were males, they were so intent in that that they were staggering around in the dark because they were blind. And so we see in there the first case of a homosexuality, and we see in the New Testament God's condemnation of that, as well as we do there in the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, because the wickedness of that city had gone up before the Lord, and He said, these people can't live anymore. The first case of circumcision is in Genesis 17, verse 10 through 14. And the theme of circumcision is throughout the Bible. It is even used as an analogy of our relationship with the Lord in the New Testament, the book of Galatians. And so the Bible speaks very clearly of this. David was one a little later on that he and Saul sent him out and told him to bring back 100 foreskins of the Philistines. That has to do with circumcision, circumcising adult men. David brought back 200 and presented those to Saul. Again, sexuality, and in that case, we have something that might be close to mutilation. Again, you study that for yourself. But the Bible talks about that. The circumcision was the sign of the covenant that was there between God and Abraham and the promises God made to Abraham, Genesis 17, verse 10 through 14. In Genesis 38, we have a case that is probably the closest case to masturbation that we see in the Bible. I'm going to use some terms that are a little plain here. But we see probably the first case of interrupting the sexual act. What we see there is in Genesis 38, verse 9 and 10. It says that Onan spilled his seed upon the ground. He was commanded to raise up seed to his brother who was dead, and he interrupted the sex act, and his seed spilled on the ground intentionally, and God killed the man for that. You can look at that and see what that means in terms of coitus interruptus. But that would be a place that you'd want to look if you're going to be thinking about that. The first case of rape was with Dinah in Genesis 34, verses 2 through 31, a rather lengthy dialogue about the family taking vengeance upon the perpetrators of this rape. That's the patriarchal age. When we move into the Mosaic age, we find a number of restrictions. And the first is we read about unlawful marriages in Leviticus 18, 1 through 18, and Leviticus 20, 11 through 21. We read about prohibited relationships. That is, that you can't marry anyone that's closer than your first cousin. There were penalties for incest that were under the law of Moses. That is, if we have close relatives, closer than the law allowed, if they were involved with one another sexually, the incest, if it was with someone closer than the law allowed, then the penalty for incest was death. Now again, this is God's law. And what we begin to do is we begin to get an understanding of how God views certain things. There are certain things God says, no, that's it. We're not doing this. And the penalty was death. Israel was to cause them to be stoned to death. Then we find unlawful intercourse, even with husband and wife. In Leviticus chapter 18, verse 19, and chapter 20 and verse 18, there are two verses there that deal with those that are married and having sexual intercourse during the woman's period. And that is called in the Bible her time of uncleanness. And that is prohibited under the old law, the law of Moses. Again, you'll have to look at that as to the application today. I'm going to talk more about that as we get down a little later. Then adultery is spoken about, and the penalty for adultery in Leviticus 19, verse 20 through 22, Deuteronomy 22, verse 22 through 24, the penalty for adultery under the old law, you didn't get a second chance, death. Do you begin to see how strictly God looks upon the sexual activity? Then we see the law on rape in the law of Moses. Deuteronomy 22, verse 22 through 29, for a damsel that was betrothed, or a married woman, the penalty was death, the death of both parties if it was committed in the city, because the woman did not cry out. So she didn't cry out, she died, she was to be killed too. But if it was in the country, then it was only the death of the man, because there was no one in the country to hear the woman's screams. That was the law of Moses. For a damsel that was not betrothed, the girl's father was to pay 50 shekels, and the man was to marry the woman and could not divorce her. That's the law of Moses. Fornication with a maiden that included whoredom, that is, that she's doing that in exchange for money, in Exodus 22, 16 and 17, Deuteronomy 23, 17, Leviticus 29 and verse 9, the penalty for that was death, except for a maiden that was a virgin. And in that case, she was mandated to marry the man. In Leviticus 20, verse 15 and 16, the topic of sex with other than human is discussed. And it's disgusting. That is, that in that passage, what we find is sex with a beast or with an animal. Human and animal sex relation. And the penalty was death for both the person and the beast. Again, do you see how many death penalties are connected with sex outside of the marriage? The case of sodomy, Leviticus 20 and verse 12, that is homosexuality. The penalty was that both were to be killed. Again, the death penalty. Now, God has some pretty strict views here, if we haven't picked up on it yet, some very strict views on people's sex life. And the law of Moses was very specific about this. There were some other sexual laws that were out there. For instance, in terms of marriage, a brother's widow was to marry the brother, and children were to be raised up to the dead brother. That would make you choose your families well, wouldn't it? You might end up marrying the ugly, nasty brother or something. But Deuteronomy 21, verse 10 through 14. Also, we find that father and son could not cohabit with the same female. It was an abomination before God. In terms of the fetishes, sexual behaviors, Deuteronomy 22 and verse 5 says that there was to be no cross-dressing, that a man would not wear that which pertained to a woman, nor a woman that which pertained to a man, that it is an abomination before God. And so the cross-dressing was deleted from accepted activity under the law of Moses. Then, women who were suspected of adultery, there were some regulations on that. Numbers 5, verse 11, and also verse 21, you can read that. A bride that was suspected of fornication, that is, that a man thought he was marrying a virgin, and it turns out that the tokens of her virginity were not present, she was to be stoned to death. That's the law of Moses. In terms of eunuchs and illegitimates, then Deuteronomy 23, verse 1 and 2, say that they are not welcome in the congregation of God's people. They were forbidden to be in the congregation. Just let me ad lib on that. Do you realize the Ethiopian eunuch traveled several thousand miles to stand outside to worship? Talk about faith. This man traveled several thousand miles just to stand outside to worship. And then as he rides back, he's reading from Isaiah, kind of glad he got the opportunity just to stand outside. That's powerful to me. But eunuchs and those that were illegitimate are spoken about in that Deuteronomy 23, 1 and 2. Now here's something that I want to talk also about, is that in our day and age, we have strayed so much in our culture from the Bible that we no longer use the term illegitimates, or the term the Bible uses in Hebrews is bastards. And we no longer use that term or those terms, but God didn't stop using them. God sees illegitimate children as those that are born outside of wedlock, And he uses that for an illustration. We stopped using that. We talk about baby mama and all that kind of stuff today. But the Bible had some very strict things to say about that, that you just didn't do that. That appears to be okay anymore in our culture, but it's not okay with God. The Ten Commandment preamble to the law of Moses was, "Thou shalt not commit adultery." That was one of the ten things in the Ten Commandment. Not coveting your neighbor's wife was another one of those in Exodus 20. Now, God's people have always gotten in trouble when it came to being involved in sexual activity outside of marriage. For instance, you remember Balaam and the matter at Baal-Peor. And there we find there were 23,000 of God's people that died. Do you remember Balaam's diabolical advice to the king? He said, I can't curse them, but you can do something that will cause God to curse them. And what you can do is you can get your women to go in here and seduce the men in the camp, and God himself will curse. And there were 23,000 Israelites that were killed in that matter at Baal-Peor that had to do with immorality, that had to do with sex, with sexual activity with the foreign people, that were foreign women that were in the camp. Numbers chapter 22 through chapter 24 gives a great deal of detail to that. And 1 Corinthians 10 and 8 reminds God's people in the New Testament days to remember that matter at Baal-Peor. David and Bathsheba is a classic in terms of looking and lusting and setting up the scene for immorality and the horrible consequences that came from that. I believe it's not coincidental that there in chapter 11 of 2 Samuel, we read about David and Bathsheba. And then in the very next chapter, we read about some fantasy that one of David's sons was having. His son, Amnon, was having fantasies about his sister, and his sister Tamar. And Tamar, she appeared to be pretty innocent in the thing. And so the son then received some diabolical advice from Jonadab. Well, here's what you need to do. You need to get her alone. You act like you're sick and get in bed here and get in sick and tell your dad that you're sick and have her to come and be your nursemaid and then grab hold of her and have sex with her. That was Jonadab's advice. Well, unfortunately, Amnon followed that advice. And as a result of that, I want you to look now in 2 Samuel chapter 12, verse 2 through 15, and here's the end of that story. He loved her so much that he was sick, is what it says in the beginning of that chapter. But then at the end of it, it says, after he had forced her, and here's the words, and the hatred wherewith he hated her was greater than the love wherewith he loved her. I want to suggest to you that when people involve themselves in immorality, they are never the same. The feelings of the fantasy are not the feelings that are produced in the reality. Now I've got to stop and ask the question, what on earth made this man think that he could do this? Well, his friend gave him some diabolical advice, but do you remember the chapter before? We have a pretty bad example because here Daddy goes out and has sex with Bathsheba, another man's wife, and the very next chapter, that was definitely crossing the boundaries. The very next chapter, the son here is doing the same thing. I wonder if he got the idea, well, Daddy did it, why can't I? And you see how a role model is necessary? We need male role models in our cultures. We need males that teach people how to be a male. As a matter of fact, when we get into our next lesson, what we will note is one of the significant things that's missing in terms of the pornography and the masturbation that goes with that. One of the significant things missing in the lives of those involved in that conduct is significant male relationships. And I'll talk more about that in the next hour. But that evidently was missing in this man's life too, except he had a pretty bad friend that gave him some pretty diabolical advice. There were warnings about making oneself vulnerable and seductive. And I wish that we had so much more time. But if you want to, the wisdom literature of the Old Testament is full of information on this. For instance, in Proverbs, the second chapter, and if you get tired, listen to me, just read that. But in verses 16 through 19, what we are told here is that the words of the Lord are to deliver us from the strange woman or the prostitute, even from the foreigner that flatters with her words, this passage says. God's words are there to keep us away from that. Verse 19, her house inclines to death and her paths unto the dead. And that tells us basically, if you want to die, and you can die spiritually when you get involved in sexual immorality, you can sever relationships because of your guilt and your shame. You can sever relationships with God by getting involved in sexual stuff that you have no business involved in. You and I can both do that and suffer the consequence. David had tremendous shame and guilt because of what he did. Chapter 5 of Proverbs, verse 1 through 14, talks about the seduction of an immoral woman in this case, and tells us to drink waters out of our own cistern. In other words, you need to be with your own wife, not be out here lusting after people. And he says in verse 18 and 19 to the married, he says that the married are to rejoice in the wife of thy youth as a loving hind, that's a deer, and a pleasant doe. Let her breast satisfy thee at all times, and be thou ravished always with her love. For why should thou, my son, be ravished with a strange woman and embrace the bosom of a foreigner? And you can read on down through there. But look at that. What he says is, you need, if you're going to follow God's order, that we marry, we have sexual expression in that marriage, and that our delight and our ravish, we are ravished. That's the idea that we're passionate about this relationship. It talks about her anatomy here in a couple phrases earlier. And there he says that is how we find our expression, not with that strange woman. And why should you be ravished with a stranger? And when we get to the New Testament, we find about the two being one, and we'll talk about that in just a moment. But we find that here in this passage. So fantasies and making oneself vulnerable. Chapter 6 of Proverbs, verse 18 through 21. He that commits adultery with a woman's void of understanding, he doeth it who would destroy his own soul. And he talks about a young man that went out trying to find somebody to have sex with, and how he walks down the street and how he is as a fool for what he got involved in there. You can read those in your Bible, but I want you to see the Bible talks about that. It talks about going on the prowl for somebody, for a sex maid. It talks about taking another man's wife. And God very clearly has a very strong view on that. Again, the idea of being ravished with the wife of your youth. In the wisdom literature, there's a book that we don't study very much, but maybe that's part of our problems in our day and time. But it's the book of the Song of Solomon. And in this, Song of Solomon is actually a stage play. And the stage play is about a lustful Solomon who sees this woman that's a hot mama. He sees the Shunammite woman as a hot mama. And she's in love with this shepherd boy back home. And Solomon's trying to seduce her. And in that book, what we see is that he describes her in such vivid, vulgar terms, as he's trying to seduce her and talk sexual to her and all that. But her heart, her true romance, her true love of her life is back home, the shepherd boy back in the hills. And Solomon cannot quench the love that she has for the shepherd boy. Finally, Solomon lets her go, and she goes back to the young man of her dreams, and she talks about her dreams in there and all that. Read that. It's a stage play. And if you understand that some of the shifts in there are shifts of character. So this is a line for one, and this is a line for another. And when you read it that way, that book starts making a lot of sense. I don't know anywhere else in the Bible talks about romantic love in the way the Song of Solomon does. And that all the passion and lust that some vulgar person may have for you, that is not going to win out, and that's not gonna conquer true love. You hold out for the real thing. That's what God wants you to do. And that's where you'll find satisfaction. Not out here being ravished with those that are immoral. The New Testament, we can go to the Old Testament as well, in the book of Hosea. And here, God wanted Israel to see how it felt to be cheated on. They had cheated, they had played the harlot. There again, the Bible says that. They had been involved in whoredom, and that's not a very positive term in the Old Testament. They had been involved in that. And so Hosea was given probably the most difficult commandment that anyone ever was given, and it was a singular commandment. He was to go and to find a woman out of whoredom and to marry her. And that's how the book of Hosea unfolds. Read that sometime if you haven't already. The book of Hosea. So he marries a woman named Gomer. That's not Gomer Pyle. That's a woman named Gomer. So he marries this woman, and the first child that's born is his child. He had no question about that. Second child that's born, he's kind of wondering, is this my child? And the third child is like, this kid isn't my kid. And then it pictures how God felt, how Israel cheating on God, playing the harlot with God by going into idolatry and following the ways of the heathen, and how God felt. He felt like a cheated husband in a relationship. And Hosea was able to write from that perspective in that book of what it's like to be cheated on. The symbolism of whoredom is throughout the whole Old Testament. And we would do well to listen to those terms. In the New Testament, we go to the book of Matthew. And Jesus says, and I'd like for you to turn there, Matthew 5. And Jesus says here in the Sermon on the Mount, he's given kind of the preamble to his New Testament law. This is that Sermon on the Mount that introduces basically the whole gospel concepts. And here's what he says in verse 27 through 29. You heard it said of old, thou shalt not commit adultery. But I say unto you that everyone that looks on a woman to lust after her has committed adultery already with her in his heart. Now you're aware of that passage. Read the next verse. And if thy right eye cause thee to stumble, pluck it out and cast it from thee. For it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish, and not thy whole body in hell. And if thy right hand cause thee to stumble, cut it off and cast it from thee. For it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish, and not thy whole body go into hell. And then he talks about divorce and remarriage. Why in the world is this thing about your eye and your hand in the middle of this context of sexual stuff? You don't have to be a real genius to figure that one out. What he is saying is, what does the eye do? The eye is that with which we lust. What does the hand do? That's that with which masturbation's done. What is he saying? He says, in this passage, look at it closely, look at the context. What he is saying is, you do not look to lust, and if you can't control yourself, you'd be better to be an amputee or to be blind than to get involved in this kind of activity. That's what the context is. Do not lust. Paul said to Timothy, flee youthful lust, that war against the soul. We're not supposed to see how close we can get to immorality. We're supposed to see how far away we can get from it. We are not to play with this stuff. It is not playing back. Human passion is powerful, but it's designed to be expressed in marriage and marriage only, according to the Scriptures. We see terms in the Bible like fornication in the New Testament. And there the word fornication is used actually as the broader term between fornication and adultery. Adultery is generally used as sexual activity between people who are married. Okay, not to each other, but they're married. So a man that's married, if he has a sex act with someone else, that's adultery. But in terms of fornication, the term fornication is used in a broader sense. It has to do with any illicit activity outside of marriage, including homosexuality. All right, how in the world did you come up with that? Well, go over to Jude, verse 7. There's only one chapter there in Jude. And what you will see is this word fornication used right there, and is connected with the sin of sodomy. Look at this. Even as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities about them, that's your seven total cities, have in like manner with these given themselves over to fornication and gone after strange flesh, are set forth as an example, suffering the punishment of eternal fire. He uses fornication in connection with Sodom and Gomorrah, where the sin of homosexuality was. I believe there he's showing a much broader definition than just heterosexual sexual conduct. In Romans, the first chapter, in verse 29, there we find fornication again condemned. Men burning with men and women with women, burning in their lust one toward another. Then we see lasciviousness talked about. Now, lasciviousness is in 1 Peter 4, verse 3 and 4, among other verses. And that word lasciviousness means that which inclines us to lust. In other words, it's whatever it is that's going to turn you on. Whatever's turning up your buttons here. Whatever's turning the heat on in your passion. And what he says is stay away from it. In Galatians 5, he says this is a work of the flesh. And those that practice such shall not inherit the kingdom of heaven. It is not okay to go around turning each other on outside of marriage. Relationship is important. And the Bible talks in Hebrews 12:8. There's where the word bastard is used. And God says that natural children, those born inside of a marriage, have one relationship, and those born outside of a marriage have a different relationship. That means something. That means something. He talks about whoremongers and adulterers God will judge in 1 Timothy 1, verse 9 through 11. Hebrews 13 and 4, marriage is honorable among all, and the bed undefiled, but whoremongers and adulterers God will judge. Now what is a whoremonger? It's a person that goes out trying to find somebody to sleep with. That's what a whoremonger is. Our strip clubs are full of them. Our streets are full of them. Sodomy is talked about in Romans 1, verse 26 through 28, and 31 and 32. And there in that Romans chapter, the thing that just stands out so much to me in that chapter is what God said three times, for this cause God gave them up. That's one of the worst statements in the Bible. Because what it said is that God gave them up. He just turned them over to what they were doing. It's almost like they were beyond hope. They had reached a point where they could not return. Someone says, oh, that's pretty strong, Art. Pretty strong where they cannot return. Sometimes you can get so far down the road in your perversion that you don't know the way back home. It becomes a lifestyle. 2 Peter talks about those that had eyes full of adultery and that cannot cease from sin. They had been involved in it so long that they could not find their way back. There was a young man that was involved in some pretty big chain of sexual activities. And he and I were talking, and he asked the question. He said, Art, what do I do? He said, I would give anything to be innocent again. I would give anything. What do I need to do? And I asked him, I said, well, are you sure you'll be willing to give anything? And I said, if you want me to work with you to accomplish that, then I need a pledge of celibacy from you for the next 2 years. We're going to have to go back and try to restore your innocence. We can go so far that our body memories overwhelm us and we can't find the way back. In marriage, though, and I don't mean to sound totally negative about sexual stuff, but so the Bible does flavor all this in terms of in marriage. And God regulates that in marriage. And the sex act, the sexual act in marriage is a beautiful thing. It's what God intends. Marriage is honorable and all. And the bed undefiled. That is, there's not supposed to be anybody else in bed with you, in your head or in your heart or connected with you in any way. In 1 Corinthians 7, verse 1 through 7, there are some regulations there about husbands and wives that are to render their due to each other. That means that your marriage is supposed to do what married people do. And it says that you don't withhold from each other, except by consent for a season, that Satan tempts you not through your incontinency. What that says is, wives and husbands, don't defraud or deprive your wife of their sexual due. That we need to have consideration for each other. And that that we render our due. If there is a decision to abstain from sex for a little while, it is to be for a season, not for ongoing. Now, here's what I'm seeing. In the marriage couples that, and this is in the church and out, the couples that I'm seeing in various therapy sessions, one of the big issues that is there is like, well, when's the last time you all cohabited? And I'm getting answers like, a year, 2 years, it's been 5 years. And it's like, is something physically going on here? Well, no, we just don't turn each other on anymore. And why is he going to the internet? And why is she starting to dress a little nicer and bought some new lingerie just out of clear blue? And is coming home late from the office? Render your due to each other. That's part of what the promise is in the vows. Relationship needs to not be just roommates, not just business partners. Marriage involves sexual expression. Now, in 1 Peter 3, verse 1 through 7, the husband's to deal with his wife according to honor, or he's to deal with his wife giving honor unto the woman as unto the weaker vessel. And guys, I'm just going to say this real clear, is most of the guys I talk to are kind of stupid when it comes to sex. They're thinking about themselves and they're not thinking about her. The sexual act isn't you run home and you hop in bed. The sexual act, women are more into relationship as a general rule. And it's about the wooing and about the feeling safe and about giving honor to her. And it's not about just running home because you've been thinking about that all day and hopping in the bed. Some men in marriage have almost brutalized their wives and aren't even aware of it. The sexual act in marriage is intended to be something that is tender, something that is special, and something that is anticipated, and something that is mutual. And husbands and wives need to learn to be tender. Gentlemen, that's what giving honor to the wife as unto the weaker vessel. And that word weaker doesn't mean that she's like a weakling. What it means is she's more fragile. Let me explain that. Did you ever go into a beautiful, into a flower shop and you see this beautiful vase? I call it a vase. But this vase. And it's this beautiful thing sitting up here. And you know, the florist asks you, well, would you rather have one of these or one of those? And if you're cheap, you say, well, just give me one of those. And what they give you is an old clay pot with some tin foil on it and some flowers in it. Well, guys, we're the old pot. We're the piece of clay. We're not very fragile. We're the pot. But that woman's not. She is fragile. She is one to be gentle with. She's one to be tender with. She's one that needs that assurance of relationship. And men do too. But treat her with honor as unto the weaker vessel or the more delicate vessel, as being also joint heirs of the grace of life. Now look at it. It says, guys, to the end that your prayers be not hindered. If you don't treat your wife right, you don't give honor to her as the weaker vessel, it can hinder your spiritual relationship before God, specifically your prayer life. You don't want to mess with that. So be good to your wife. Don't be out here going down the mall looking at everybody else. Rejoice in the wife of your youth. That's what the Bible says. Well, the violation of the marriage relationship is so serious that God does one time what He hates. In the book of Malachi, God says, I hate putting away divorce. But in the book of Matthew, Jesus says, no, you don't divorce for any reason except for the cause of fornication and remarry. And there it's a choice. Matthew 5:27, following Matthew 19:7. And here's the point I'm making, is that God allows what He hates. And here's why. Why does He allow what He hates? Because He hates a cheating mate more. And He makes the exception to what He hates. To the single person, the New Testament talks about the relationship of a virgin daughter and the parents of a virgin daughter, 1 Corinthians 7. In 1 Thessalonians 4, verse 3 through 8, I'd like for you to turn there. And here, this passage talks about our bodies, and that we are to possess ourselves in the right kind of way. I'm reading from the American Standard Version, and here's what it says: For this is the will of God, even your sanctification, that ye abstain from fornication. Now, let's stop there just a minute. He says what about fornication? About abstaining from fornication? This is the will of God. You abstain from fornication. And He says, not only it's the will of God, but it involves your sanctification. That is, you being set apart as holy and as honorable before God. Abstain from fornication. Then look at verse 4. That each one of you know how to possess himself of his own vessel in sanctification and honor. Now, mine says vessel. Yours, I'm not sure how it reads, but you can look at it and read it. Here's what this means. This means, and this word vessel, as it's translated in the American Standard, has to do with our sexual organs. And what it says is, you protect your sexual organs, you conduct in honor those parts of you that are sexual, and you hold those in honor and in sanctification. The body is not for fornication. It is for the Lord, 1 Corinthians 6. Can't make it any clearer than that. Not in the passion of lust, even as the Gentiles who know not God. So who's involved in not possessing themselves in honor? The heathen, the people who don't know God. Now, do you see how that's there? That's one of the strongest passages we can talk about on that. Okay? We're to feed our mind with pure things. Someone says, well, how do I do this? How do I get away from this passion? How do I get away from when I got the hots? How do I get away from all that? Well, what we do is we do a thing called thought stopping. And the Bible talked about that long before anybody ever thought about labeling it thought stopping. But Philippians, the 4th chapter, tells you what to think about. Now, if you'll think about the things that are pure, the things that are of good report, all those things, anything of virtue and praise, think on these things. You remember the verse, Philippians 4 and verse 8. That's what you're supposed to think about. Do a little thought stopping. We don't plan our day on who can I seduce today. We plan our day on how can I serve God today. Because we're Christians. 1 Corinthians 6, verse 18 through 20. Flee fornication. We are to beware of people, places, and things that are going to seduce and entice us. Galatians 5, 19 through 21, the works of the flesh. And again, we're told to come out from among them and be separate and touch not the unclean thing, because God will reward us for our proper behavior. So, in summarizing this, what we have is sexual expression outside of marriage is called a work of the flesh. Homosexuality is called that which is without natural affection. Lust is talked about that we are not to look to lust. That is, checking people out. Go out here looking at folks to see if we can get turned on by looking at them. That means don't be looking down people's blouses. That means don't be checking underneath the bench to see how somebody's sitting. That means keep your eyes in the right place. If your eye offends you, Now, don't anybody do this. Don't anybody go cut your hand off or pluck your eye out, because I think that we're mature enough that we can figure out how to control ourselves without going to that extreme. If you get ready to do that, call me. 2 Peter 2:14 talks about those with eyes full of adultery that cannot cease from sin. They've gone so far that they don't know the way back. The familiar has become entrenched. And then 2 Timothy 3:13, evil men and seducers shall wax worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived. We live in a nation of perverts. We have some of the expressions that are going on in our day and time. Who on earth would ever thought of some of that? Upskirting. The bestialities that are going on. Just everything you can imagine, and many things that you should not even let go through your mind is out there in the way of perversion. One of the first times that a Christian ever came to me was a man came to me, and he was telling me that his wife had gone in a sex shop and had bought a machine that would perform sexually on her as he would, and that he was all frustrated because he could not outperform the machine. The machine could go on for days, and he wanted to know, "How do I deal with this?" And I want to admit to you that when that was the first thing came to me, it's like, I need some more education. Perversion. These things ought not ever to be named among us. But they are. 2 Peter 2:12 through 22 talks about those who entice unsteadfast souls into adultery. And what it says is there is God has preserved for them, look at this term, the blackness of darkness. It doesn't get any darker than that. The blackness of darkness. And then look at the context. He talks about there, after we have escaped the pollution of the world and we're again entrapped therein, the latter end is worse with us than the beginning. That's the context of that verse. And he says it's like a dog going back to their vomit and an old sow to wallowing in the stinky mire. And the context has to do with the blackness of darkness. Read the chapter. Now, we have a contrast. The worldly man is going to be characterized by lust and passion, eyes full of adultery. He's going to be a whoremonger. He's going to have wounds. By the way, on wounds, let me explain to you about one fellow came to me. And what he had done is he was in the habit of collecting the underwear of every woman he'd ever slept with. And he had them on his wall like a trophy. And as he talked to me, his statement was, "Art, I would give anything to feel innocent again." Now here's the problem. Here's a problem. I heard one of the ladies in group, one of my groups, a young lady, and she said she had been raped, and she made the statement, and she had become very promiscuous after that. And what she said is, "Art, after someone takes it from you, it doesn't matter who's second or who's third." And it's like, oh, I beg to differ. Because your body has memories. And you carry those memories with you. And those memories are stored. And those memories can come out. And so every time that you get involved in sex outside of marriage, all you're doing is you're just compounding the problem more and more and more and more. And I've also talked to some that have compounded the problem a lot. And what I find is, as they talk, they're very frigid, they're turned off by sexuality almost altogether. And I'm going to talk about that a little bit more the next hour. So, we have godly men who have a pure mind, who flee fornication, they have a respect for God's order, they possess their vessel in honor, they're satisfied with their wife, They make themselves eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake. And their example is, what would Jesus do? Godly women from all this, the summary, is, I'm sorry, worldly women, are wily of heart, that means deceitful of heart. They are externally focused, such as with the attire of a harlot, or with the seduction, the lips as honey, as the proverb writer talks about, trying to be out here being hoochie mama and being sexy. They're seductive, they're enticing, they're carousing and involved in revelry. That's how the Bible pictures them. But on the other hand, the godly woman is virtuous, has an inner beauty of holiness. She is chaste, C-H-A-S-T-E, whereas the ungodly woman is chaste, C-H-A-S-E-D. It's the difference. And they possess their vessel in honor. They know the body is not for fornication, but for the Lord. And they also follow the example of what would Jesus do. And even more so, they realize, men and women, that if they're not married, the person that one day, if they're to get married, the person one day that they are planning to marry, that person is alive today. And the question is, what would I want them to be doing to prepare for me when we're married? I would like to think that would be being virtuous, being the kind of person that would be a good mate, and not being out here giving ourselves to anybody and everybody that comes along. Now, I've just touched the hem of the garment. Do you see why I would say that the Bible gives some pretty specific sexual instruction? And what we need to do is realize this. Our schoolroom for sexual conduct is not the internet. Our schoolroom for our sexual behavior is not the shower rooms and locker rooms. Families need to talk about this. This is a part of who we are. It's not something to be ashamed of, but it's something to be held in honor and dignity, and it's something we need to talk about. And here's the thing. If we don't talk to our families about it, somebody will. And they'll get information that may or may not be accurate. And they will act on that information. So let us be about teaching what God says about it. And explore these and many, many other verses that are going to help us to understand God's will. Sexual conduct is reserved for marriage. Until then, the shop's closed and the passion meter's turned down or off. Let's take a little break.